So as you know, I had a really, really good time in Key West.
I saw that. Yes, I saw that. And indeed.
So the one thing that was really interesting. So there's a 3-level bar, and on the bottom is the Bull Bar, and the second one is the Whistle. It's got a nice veranda. It oversees Duval. And
okay.
The third level is clothing optional. It's called the Garden of Eden. And I went up there, and I was so happy to see you.
Well, you know, I try, my friend. I had a fig leaf going, but, you know, I figured, why not just go au naturel? That's, you know, that's the only way to go to Florida, really.
It's the only way to go.
Just remember, everybody, your story to tell. Tell it well. I'm just old marketing.
And now, for your listening pleasure, here's Polizzi and Rose, covering the week of media, marketing, and digital content news. This Old Marketing. Take it away, boys.
Well, hello, friends. Welcome to This Old Marketing, proudly brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. And I'm Robert Rose. Welcome to episode number 423 for Friday, April 12th, 2024. And with me, as always, as he always is my pal, my colleague, and a guy who definitely knows, what's up, brother? Tuesday. Special plays, special players, and special teams. Mr. Joe Polizzi.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
You have no idea.
I have no idea.
You should.
What?
You should know what I'm talking about.
What are you talking about? I feel bad when I don't know a reference, but you're going to fill me in.
Well, okay. So, and your kids will know this, especially one of your kids will know this. No, this is Stitch from, he's a big Twitch star. Is now a TikTok star. He plays football, on video game football. He's special. And he's basically he's now become a viral star, because he has his little sayings. He's got lots of little sayings, but the most incredible one that has gone completely viral and is making its rounds on TikTok is the "What's up, brother?" And so the meme right now is that you walk up to any man and you go, "What's up, brother?" And then they go, "Oh, special teams, special plays, special players, Tuesday. So, yeah, that's his saying. It's his sort of catchphrase.
I am so thankful that I'm not on TikTok.
I am keeping up with what the kids are dancing to so that you don't have to, my friend. That is what I do for you. It's the love that
worth,
I have for you.
Is it worth it? Is the mind?
It is totally worth it. Yeah. It is totally worth it. I'm very entertained by the whole thing. I have to tell you, I'm totally entertained.
If I spent 2 seconds on TikTok, it would be 6 hours in such a short period of time. That's why I have to watch myself. Because on Facebook, as I'm, you know, because I posted a whole thing, like, here's what I did at Key West. We had some great pictures, and I like to do my itinerary because I want my Facebook posts to be useful to people. So they're like, "Oh yeah, when I go to Key West, these are all the things we got to do." Because everyone was so helpful giving me advice on what I should do. And then you sort of see below where you get into reels, and every once in a while I'll see something, and, "Oh, what's that?" And then down the rabbit hole I go. It's just not good. It's not good for me.
It is good. Yes, I've decided. Here's what I've decided. I've decided that Facebook, Insta, and Threads, for me anyway, are the nonsense networks, right? They are where I'm going to go. And this includes TikTok is for me. Other than what we do with the show, I haven't created a lot of content for TikTok, but but those three, so it's more of a content consumption network for me. But basically, I just find, you know, fun things, right? Fun nonsense, you know, links to music that I love, you know, pictures of sunsets, you know, drinks, you know, food, you know, fun, interesting things. I am not trying to be useful on Facebook or Insta.
There's a lot to learn from your Facebook commentary, because I would say that when I post something, and you, I would say every third or fourth time you might comment on something if it's getting a lot of virality or whatever. Yours is always like the most liked or laughed at comment, because you put a lot of thought into your commentary.
I do. Somebody. I do.
And it's always insightful or funny, or I didn't really think, you know, I didn't think about it that way. So,
well, thank you for that.
Just a really good social media strategy, because then yours comments always goes to the top. Like if you were in it for any kind of business reason, you're doing it the right way, because you're commenting on posts that are doing very well, but then you always have the best comment.
Well, thank you. That's true. Fun. Yeah,
true.
That's
true.
Fine. That's true. Fine.
Yeah, but anyways, just to wrap up the whole Key West thing, I love the vibe.
Isn't it great, that
island, I guess.
Key West is not Florida. It is something different.
I know you hate different. Florida, but you don't hate Key West, because
I don't hate Key West. Yeah.
Nobody can hate Key West.
No.
And we, as you know, a lot of people listening to this might not know, in the 6 days that we were there with a couple of friends of ours, we went to 30 establishments. We kept track.
Fantastic.
We tried all the drinks.
Key West is a Jimmy Buffett song in reality. I mean, that's what it is.
What's amazing is, too, of course, we took the little conk train around and got the tour. They stop and say, here's the spot where Jimmy Buffett had his guitar case open and was playing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, here's not, you know, he just recently passed away. By the way, there was a thank you, Jimmy, everywhere on the island. Thank you, Jimmy, for everything you did. But here's a person who had nothing and was singing his own stuff on a street corner and became a multi-billionaire. And, yep. You know, just to see that happen and how supportive. I know of music towns like New Orleans, like Nashville, even like Cleveland to an extent, depending on, you get different types and feels. But sure. I had no idea the music scene of Key West. It is, you go into any location, somebody there is not a nobody. Like they've been on like one of these American Idol shows, or they're fairly popular. They've got a really good following. I was really impressed. So I can't rave about Key West enough. And plus, I mean, it was 80 degrees and sunny.
Oh, it's a beautiful place.
And not hot.
Yeah,
there's lots of shade when you walk around, too.
Well, you visited at a very opportune time of year. I mean, you go in July or August, and it's a different kind of thing. But yeah,
we did all the things, and
that's amazing.
I was so excited, and I want to go back. And I was looking at property, and my wife said, "Stop it now! You would get too bored. You need to go to a city where there's sports and theater." But I would like to go down to Key West again. Yeah. Very soon, because I loved it so much.
So you were away, but did you watch the women's NCAA championship games?
So we have such a crazy life. I'm so blessed.
I know.
We missed it. The Final Four was in Cleveland, Ohio. It's like,
I know.
Five minutes from my house.
Right. Yeah.
And we're gone for the whole thing. And we get back Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock is the finals game. And we were blessed enough to get tickets for that game. So, of course, we go down there at noon and we're checking out the festivities. And thankfully, it's like 55 and sunny, which is a great day in Cleveland in early April.
Yeah.
So nobody had any problems. Cleveland looked great. All the stars were out, and we went to the game. And I got to tell you, Robert, I've been to a lot of very exciting sports games in my career as a sports enthusiast. I can't name another one that was more exciting to me, that people were more into it than that game. It was just I felt honored to be part of it. We went to the finals.
Okay.
On Sunday afternoon, we went to the South Carolina, Iowa.
South Carolina game. Yep.
Iowa, where South Carolina was by far the better team.
Oh, sure.
But it was very exciting watching Caitlin Clark, who, as listeners of this show know, 6 months ago, I had no idea who Caitlin Clark was. 3 months ago. And now I want to get a Caitlin Clark jersey. And I love Jason Sudeikis even more because he's a Caitlin Clark fan. And all the things. So, I mean, did you watch it?
I did. I watched both games on television. And what a guy, I mean, it was, both of them were great games. The South Carolina game. Yeah. You're absolutely right. They were I mean, you can argue even that UConn was the better team, than Iowa. You know, and don't at me. It was a foul, and it was a foul, and yes, it was a foul. So it was a foul.
Controversy of the previous game.
But it was great to watch. It was just great sports. You know, just great to watch. You know, it's like one of the reasons I got so tired. I've been so tired of the NBA is. It's hardly a game anymore. You know what I mean? It's just all it is, you know, it's 48 minutes of fast breaks, right? And who can showboat and hit the 3-point from the furthest away. And there's, you know, it's almost like, you know, one of the reasons that I talk about, you know, I'm a huge fan of the Superman movie. And yes, I'm about to compare Superman movie to the basketball. but one of the reasons that I didn't like the latest and really any of the recent Supermans are because you're never in doubt. There's never a doubt that he's going to come out on top, right? You're never like, ooh, worried or, you know, you just don't care because he's indestructible. And so he never gets hurt. He never, you know, he never shows pain, never, you know, and that's kind of where the NBA is with me right now. It's like, it's just, you know, it's 10 guys just sort of running around and making trick shots. And what was so great about the women's sport is that you could see the plays developing. You could see the strategy sort of forming in real time. They make mistakes. They you know, work with each other. They talk with each other. They're just as, you know, trash talking as the guys. It was just a great experience from a sports fan's point of view. And I just love it. I love the fact that they had more viewers than the men's final. It's just,
yeah, well, I know we'll talk about that in a second, which I think is newsworthy. What I loved, the shirts that Jason Sudeikis was wearing, and they were selling them there. It says, "Everyone watches women's sports." And I was like, that's odd. And then I thought about it. I'm like, yes, if you are at a women's sporting event, you are watching, you are all in, you are there. And yeah. So I don't know what exactly is meant by that. That's how I'm taking it. But when I go to a NFL game, I'll go to a Browns game or I go to a Cavs game, there are a good portion of people that are not there for the game. They're there for corporate reasons. They're there for because somebody gave them a free ticket. They're there to socialize and drink, eat, whatever it is. But they're not there to watch the game. I was at a place where 18,300 people were there riveted.
Yeah, to watch
to
the game.
The game. And that made me happy.
Yeah.
It just made me happy.
I loved everything about it. I am now a super fan, and will be into it, you know, from this point forward. And it appears that I'm not alone. You're not alone. The marketing and the true sort of viewership jump here this year, it's you know, there was one article I saw that said it's having its Michael Jordan moment, right? Where it is now sort of pivoted and now a real thing. So we'll see if that influence sort of happens over to the women's professional side. I think it will. I've certainly started to research and say, hey, where am I going to go watch this and see it and all that kind of stuff. So,
well, let's get into the show, but I do want to mention, because I like talking about me and things that
I'm of course.
Doing.
Yeah. Let's turn it all around to you again. Yes.
Monday, I launched my book.
Oh, yes. Congratulations.
Thank you. The Content Entrepreneur. So I was in Key West when the book launches. That's the way to do it. No, I actually came back for it. So and if you are a content creator, content marketer, you'll get a lot out of this book. Myself and 32 of my content expert friends. You weren't in it, Robert. I would normally have asked you, but you're not in my little VIP club.
I know.
So it's only for people in my VIP club, but it's now available. Go to thecontententrepreneur.com or go to joepulizzi.com. And the book is great. It's super valuable, but it's, I think, how we're selling it. And we've talked about it a little bit, I think, is just as much of a story. You won't find it on Amazon. You won't find it on Barnes & Noble. You won't find it anywhere except on the CEX site or on the joepulizzi.com site. We're selling direct. You can get a paperback, hardcover, or ebook. And then we're working on the audiobook right now, which we will also sell direct. I've never done an audiobook that hasn't been on Audible. This will be the first one that's not on Audible. So please go out and buy the book. All proceeds go to charity.
Have you figured out how to centralize measurement of sales yet?
I don't know what that means when you say centralize.
Well, when basically, at some point, someone's going to ask, or someone's going to want to know.
Oh, to keep for how many, what the revenue is and the expenses, like all for the books.
No, I'm that's easy enough to track, right? Yeah. That's easy enough to track. What I mean is the how many books have you sold idea, right? Yes. So at some point, one of the things that will be interesting, I think, maybe this is something that Lulu could consider, is you're going to want a bestsellers list for books that are sold in a direct way. And so there should be a measurement technique that allows sellers to implement something, some third party or provided solution that basically measures all of the books and how they were sold. So that you really can run it full circle, right? So one of the benefits of selling through and a centralized place like an Amazon or those places is that you can get argue as you will about, whether book scan and all those things are actually accurate or not. I don't think they are, but from a certain, and certainly you can argue about bestsellers, but you'd actually have a bigger argument to be made about what a bestseller is. Because it was sold direct rather than through a Barnes and Noble or through Amazon and those sorts of things.
To answer your question, I don't know if that's being worked on obviously I know exactly how many books are being sold because I get an update every time it happens.
Yeah, of course.
And so I know those types of things. It's interesting. I think that it probably hasn't been done or hasn't been thought of because if you are selling direct, you're not interested in the bestseller game. You're not, that's not a game you're playing because it's hard to compete with that.
It only is because that's the way it is today.
Yeah, then you're right.
It doesn't mean it has to be that way tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
If you told me today there is a bestseller list of those who sell, of content creators, of authors who sell direct, I'm way more interested in that bestseller list than I am a bestseller list from, Wall Street Journal.
Well, here's the thing. Lulu can do it. Obviously, they can do it with their books. So if you're selling direct through Lulu, then great. We can absolutely make that happen if people want to be a part of that. I think the most exciting. So anyways, that's food for thought. I'll run that by.
Just asking questions.
No.
I'm Tucker Carlson. I'm just asking questions.
So you and I, we published a few books together.
Yeah.
You've published a few books without me. I've done some things on my own. We know this game pretty well. Here's the thing. It was such a different feeling, Robert, than I've had before because I see a sale and it comes in to my email or my Lulu Direct account or whatever. And I see a name, an address, and an email.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. It's an addressable audience. It's fantastic.
But you and I have sold hundreds of thousands of books over the last 15 years, and I've never once seen that. I've never gotten a name. Now, granted, you and I have written books, and people have read them, and then they've subscribed to stuff that we've done.
That's right.
We don't really know how that happens, but it's happened. So it becomes an addressable audience, but I've never seen it firsthand. Sold a book, get the information, get the data, which I think this is the play where we're going, how in this world of algorithms that we live in, how do we connect directly with our fans and our customers? And so I'm very excited about trying this
very
model.
Exciting. Yeah.
And so thank you for indulging me.
Absolutely.
I think that's a great question.
Yeah. And we've got a great show. We've got a great show. We did lots and lots to talk about. We'll try and get to as much of it as we certainly can in our time allotted us by the internet gods. And the big story that we'll cover, of course, is Google. Is it going to buy HubSpot? Big news in the marketing world this week as the sort of rumors. Is there an offer? Isn't there an offer? We'll talk a little bit about the implications of that. There is a new surprise, surprise, bipartisan privacy bill making its way into the Congress critters' backyards. And we'll talk a little bit about maybe just the surprise of that. I have not had a chance to read the bill yet. Then, of course, we'll talk about magazines and how they are making a surprise big comeback, a print magazine making a big comeback. And part of that is startup Robinhood, the technology company, also the trading platform, has launched its own new print magazine. We'll talk a little bit about print magazines and, of course, their use as a content marketing platform. We'll talk about the New York Times report that is recently out about how tech giants are cutting corners when it comes to the data and learning models around AI. And we'll talk briefly about that. In our hits and misses section, I'm going to rave on about the hit that Suno.ai, or now Suno.com, looks like they got their .com domain, about music creation with AI, and what an interesting platform that is.
Can't wait to hear about that.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, really interesting. Joe is going to talk about Jack Conte and his speech at South by Southwest on content creation and the death of the follower.
Death of the follower.
Dun, yeah. Dun, dun. And then we'll get to rants and raves, where I will talk a little bit about Andrew Huberman and his platforming, deplatforming, controversy, all that stuff as a content creator. And Joe will talk about the TikToker Kelsey Russell. And so lots of content creators being featured.
And the content marketing. Don't forget.
And content marketing, yeah.
That Robin Hood thing is a story, I think.
It's a huge story.
And I want to talk about that.
That not a lot of people are covering. Yeah, it's interesting. I know.
Nobody covers that.
Yeah.
We should be covering that. So.
We are the world-leading podcast when it comes to content marketing.
We are.
Yes, we are.
You should say that more.
I'll start saying it every show.
Yeah. No, what you focus on, you just say that the audio. I mean, that's what you've been working on in the opening. Yeah. Where you people don't know, it's fractions of a second longer every episode. I'm very impressed.
That's right. It's just one more shout out to our lovely sponsor gods up there in Boston.
Sponsor gods.
Okay. Let's get to our first story here, which is, the first one we're going to cover here is about Google and the rumors this week coming to us courtesy of CNBC, although there are a lot of mainstream news outlets covering this. And the headline is that Alphabet is reportedly weighing the offer for HubSpot, sending shares to the $32 billion company up by 5% this week. Just the rumor of an acquisition. And the article opens up by saying shares of HubSpot popped 5% on Thursday after Reuters reported that Alphabet is weighing making an offer to the marketing software company. Alphabet has in recent days discussed how much it should offer and whether antitrust officials would greenlight the deal, Reuters reported, citing people familiar with the matter. The article goes on to talk about it's a short article, but it basically covers the sort of points of view of both and what would make sense and what wouldn't make sense. But so we're both very familiar with both companies. What is your initial take on Google buying HubSpot? Make sense? Does it make sense? Would it happen? Will it happen? All of that?
I think Google, looking at any company that is founded in data acquisition, email, is a great buy these days. So I'm not surprised by it. I'd be a little interested to see if this gets past the feds. It's not a friendly environment for acquisitions right now in the tech sector. That might change. And by the way,
mirrors. I think that's a lot of smoke and mirrors right now. There's not a lot. They're not doing a lot. They're barking a lot, but they're not.
They're
doing
barking a lot. Yeah, but I think I think people have been thinking twice, let's say, about making some of these deals. By the way, we don't even know this is going to happen,
right?
No, we don't have
this. Is totally rumor at this point.
It's totally rumor. But I mean, I guess the question back to you is this a time where you're going to see more consolidation? We saw a slew of marketing automation consolidation years ago, and then of course you're like, okay, well, everybody bought each other, so where are we at now? And you had Adobe and Oracle and everyone got involved. And now are we seeing the last legs of the not that HubSpot's small, it's a $32 billion company, but
yeah,
are you seeing this is this going to happen, I guess, because you're not going to have these small automation companies anymore?
Well, they're hardly small, right? I mean, I think there are two things working in its favor. I'll cover the first thing that I think is not working in its favor, which is this would by almost 3x be the biggest acquisition that Google ever made.
That's
the Motorola acquisition was $12 billion. And at the time, people were freaking out about how big that was. This would be a $30 to $40 billion acquisition, depending on the premium they pay for the stock. This would be huge for them. This would be a big, they have somewhere in the neighborhood of $120 to $130 billion of just cash laying around. So it's not like they can't do it. And it's not like it would be highly leveraged or anything, but it's a big acquisition. So it would be really out of character for them to make this kind of acquisition. The two things that I have in its favor are, one, you said it, data. They get access to 205,000 customers of HubSpot. And by the way, by proxy, all the customers of those 205,000 businesses, all of their data as well. So content consumption data, addressability, you know, email addresses, you know, they would have all of those things. And then how that works into what I think is the most interesting longer term play of this is how it fits into Gemini and AI search, which is, imagine a world where if you're a HubSpot customer, would it be HubSpoogle? Yeah, HubSpoogle customer. You're a HubSpoogle customer.
Just do that.
Yeah, HubSpoogle. basically, if you're a HubSpoogle customer, you come in and instead of, you know, you're a business and you, instead of gating content, what if all of a sudden through my new Google Workspace, which includes HubSpoogle, of course, I can target content through the Google ecosystem, that's YouTube and Gmail and all the things, and I get special treatment for my data answering the questions in Gemini AI search. And so, in other words, I get special dispensation on all my content, my e-commerce catalog, my website, my blog, all the content that I create through the Google Workspace. And my content is what is prioritized in the Gemini AI answer of search. And in just integration alone with Google Workspace, that's reason enough to do it. You know, in other words, you say, okay, for small and medium-sized businesses, you have Google Workspace now, which is, of course, you know, a competitor to Microsoft 365 with, you know, word processing and PowerPoint presentations and Excel spreadsheets and all the things. Now you add an inbound marketing component to that and a CRM component to that. It makes a lot of sense for small and medium-sized businesses to switch over from Microsoft 365 to Google Workspace. So there's a lot of really compelling reasons, including the fact that, by the way, all the oxygen is getting sucked out of the air of ad tech right now, and Google has to diversify out of that and get into marketing technology and data. So a lot of reasons to do this.
That's a really good point, because there's no denying the fact that they're worried about their search business, and they should be. Because as we've talked about, there are more and more people going to whatever AI, ChatGPT, whatever engine, they're moving away from Google search. And I think you and I have both seen over the past many months, Google search and their sponsorships have just gotten out of hand.
Yeah,
it's kind of ridiculous. Yeah. But what's also interesting is you have these HubSpot customers that are sending all these emails out, automation, whatever the case is. So if you had a nice little partnership with you called it HubSpoogle, if you had a nice little partnership, I wonder if that would help your deliverability into Gmail.
Of course it will.
That's a huge deal. One of the biggest issues right now for email marketing is the fact that you can't get through the promotions tab.
Yep.
For Google. Well, I think we found a solution for that.
Yep. So 100%. Absolutely. Yes. All that integration would be incredible. I mean, just how useful Gemini becomes in the interface of a HubSpot versus where it is, how useful it is in the interface of something like a Gmail is just, it's incredible. It's way more useful in HubSpot than it is as a, you know, help me make my Gmail a little better, right?
Well, and also to make this case, I didn't quite understand when Intuit bought MailChimp and what that would do. And I mean, that seems to be a very important acquisition overall for Intuit.
Yeah.
And the way that they're growing that. So, I mean, it's interesting that the role that email and data are playing in all this, and we'll see where it goes. But
yeah.
Who knows what's going to happen? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Very quickly here, we'll cover our second big news story of the week. And it is about a new bipartisan privacy bill has been unveiled. And this story, I mean, there's a number of other mainstream news items that are covering this. This is coming from IAP. And basically, as it opens up, it says, in a surprise development, and it is actually very surprising, on April 5th, two key members of U.S. Congress released a draft bipartisan bicameral federal privacy bill. A little more than 2 years removed from the last significant attempt to forge national privacy law, U.S. House Committee on Energy and Commerce Chair Kathy McMorris-Rogers, who's a Republican from Washington, And Senator Maria Cantwell, a Democrat out of Washington and chair of the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation, went on the record Sunday to discuss the newly released draft legislation. By the way, Maria Cantwell is one of the very underappreciated representatives who does really, really good work. She just does that, just, and she comes out of the tech space. Anyway, basically, the article goes on to talk about the 53-page bill, which proposed, it's called the American Privacy Rights Act. It includes requirements on data minimization, consumer rights to opt out of targeted advertising, view, correct, export, or delete their data. It's very GDPR-like in that way. Additionally, the bill carries data security provisions, executive responsibility for a national data broker registry, which is very interesting. I haven't read the bill yet. I'm going to. I will definitely read the bill before next we see each other. But any initial thoughts on this coming out so quickly? And does it have a chance this year in an election year?
Well, does anything have a chance to pass? It seems that I was surprised to see this. But if I had to take a guess as while this is being pushed through, is because there are states that are coming up with their own laws, and managing data privacy on the state level is impossible to do. There's no way that you could do business and have 50 different ways that you need to run your business based on data privacy. We've talked about that for years on this show. So I think that's probably where, I mean, I don't know. Do you agree? Is that kind of where we're going, where the federal government just has to say, look, we can't, business just can't stop because of these privacy rules that are happening on the state level.
I think they have to move at some point, right? We have to have something at some point because, you know, and I think, by the way, this would not be inconsequential, right? I really think a smartly written, and I don't know, as I have said, I haven't read this bill yet, but a smartly written privacy bill, boy, would it help a lot in terms of all of the things that we talk about, you know, on this show and sort of in the sphere of marketing and digital and content, you know, around social media and privacy and all the things. There's an opportunity to make a pretty sizable impact here in terms of how misinformation, disinformation, and all sorts of things are used. You go all the way back in history. One of the, you know, the origins of the words yellow journalism came out of the late 1800s and all of the newspapers who were basically allowed to print anything they wanted, right? They could print that, you know, there was no such thing as defamation or, you know, lies, you know, all those things. They could print anything they wanted. It was yellow journalism. One of the sort of true impacts that sort of stopped yellow journalism and newspapers from putting in processes and safeguards was the discussion and some of the regulatory stuff that came out of the Supreme Court, Justice Brandeis in the days around privacy, about what individuals in the U.S. could expect from privacy. And I think that it could have just the same kind of impact here where we are in 2024. So I'm a big fan of it. I think it's a really long time coming. To your point, it ain't happening this year. I don't think anything is happening this year in an election. Nobody's going to stick their neck out here and sort of and do these things in an election year. But I'm glad that I'm glad they're coming together on it, and I'm glad that it's bipartisan.
Well, it's interesting, and I'm surprised by the amount of legislation that we're starting to talk about, because even the social media ban out of Florida, which at least for right now, unless it changes under appeal, is going to start on the 1st of January 25.
Yeah.
I expect that. If that seems to be getting support on a lot of different sides, I wonder if that could lead to a federal law as well. So we'll probably be talking more about these things as it goes.
It could. Yeah, we talked about that ad nauseum, right? But it's I think it's, this is much, for me, the federalization of this is way better than states coming up with their own.
Has to happen. So good.
Absolutely,
for that.
Absolutely. All right. Well, speaking of things having to happen, I don't know what I meant. I have no idea what I meant by that. I don't know. I'm just looking for a segue.
Let's just go to the ads. How about that?
Yeah, there you go. So much like the age-old question to skinny jean or not to skinny jean, marketing strategies can come and go and come back again.
who can keep up? Luckily, there's HubSpot's 2024 State of Marketing Report, the skinny, if you will, an all-in-one guide for what's happening this year and how marketers can best approach it all. The report covers everything from increasing awareness and engagement to ensuring privacy, boosting efficiency, and, of course, growth. Don't get caught behind the trends. Visit HubSpot.com/stateofmarketing to get your free copy of the report. You looking to hustle into a new podcast? Well, I recommend Hustle and Flowchart. The Hustle and Flowchart podcast is all about how to build a business so it gives you the freedom and fuel for your life. Join host Joe Fier as he discusses systems, mindset tweaks, reframes, and strategies for entrepreneurs, and really anyone, to enjoy the process of being in business and having fun. This isn't for the entrepreneur looking to build a billion-dollar business. Rather, someone who is looking to build systems to help you make more money than you need just by working part-time. Get the Hustle and Flowchart podcast wherever you follow your favorite pods. You want some big news? Well, the amazing team at Divi HQ have joined forces with Litho. Now, why is that important? Well, Divi has been building amazing collaboration and calendaring software for marketing teams for 13 years. And Litho, well, they've been doing the same with tools for creative and design teams. Now, just like chocolate and peanut butter, they've come together to help all marketers and content producers plan, create, and perform better together. I'm excited to share that This Old Marketing listeners get a 20% discount for life on any Divi HQ or Litho product. And that's not all. Check this out. The first 10 companies that sign up with this campaign will get a free, that's right, free one-hour content workshop with me. Yeah, that's how much we're into this. So don't wait. Visit lithoforlife.com. That's L-Y-T-H-O, lithoforlife.com to learn more.
You know what I got out of that?
What's that?
All I heard was that if they sign up, then they get free consultation for life from Robert Rose. Is that it?
It's not it.
Then I was not listening.
You definitely misheard that. Yes, they get, if they sign up, the first 10 that sign up get a one hour consultation. Thank you to the Divi guys for sponsoring the show. Yeah,
congratulations.
Something we talked about.
Congratulations on the marriage between those two wonderful companies. I'm happy for everyone involved. I know folks on both sides now, and that's good.
They're a good crew. They're definitely
It's going to be a good thing for everyone.
Absolutely. All right. Let's keep things moving sure. along here. And so to get to the fact that print is making a comeback.
Yes, it is.
Here
all
we
you go. Doubters.
Here we
you
go.
People.
Fascinating story out of Axios. Print revival, it says. Magazines making surprise comeback as marketing tool.
Ooh. Surprise.
Yeah, it was Joe Polizzi, I think, predicted that.
I'm pushing for them to write this article.
The article opens up with a very odd choice of magazines here from Nylon. Basically, Nylon, the 25-year-old fashion outlet, will release its first physical magazine this month since stopping print editions and becoming a digital-only publication in 2017, executives told Axios. And why it matters, they say, is the move is part of a larger revival of print as a marketing tool and potential advertising opportunity amid an otherwise grim digital ad outlook for publishers. The print release is timed to the 25th anniversary of the storied fashion magazine. The music-themed issue coincides Nylon House experience at the Coachella Music Festival this weekend. Nylon is a brand that was born in print and has been our goal to return to that format since we acquired it in 2019, said Emma Rosenblum, chief content officer for Nylon's parent company, BDG Media. Then they go on, by the way, to speak of a couple of others. Most pronounced was Sherwood Media, the new media company that is backed by the retail trading platform Robinhood, which is basically the content marketing arm of Robinhood. It is to Robinhood what, you know, Red Bull Media House is to Red Bull. Mm-hmm. Plans to launch a print magazine in the second half of this year. Joshua Topolsky, who is building the new outlet, told Axios that there's been a lot of advertiser interest in print. print. So it's interesting that they're taking a sort of revenue generating, somebody should write a book about that, I suppose, aspect to their marketing, which of course is all around the content, around the magazine and the print magazine in this particular case. They did a couple of other ones with, showed, I don't love the examples they took in Axios, but there when there's so many other sort of clearer examples of this. But anyway, what I mean, shall I ask for your comment, Mr. Polizzi? I mean, anything surprising in here for you?
No, it's nothing surprising. We all saw this coming. Everyone in the world saw this coming, that the new innovation in content and marketing is print.
Yeah.
That let's face it, it's harder and harder to reach your audience digitally today, especially when you're not in control of it. And the big tech companies can do whatever they want with how they rank your content, and they can disregard your followers and fans. And by the way, it's a great, if this is for a luxury brand, if you don't have a print magazine sending to your folks, what are you doing? Like, are you even in marketing? Right. Did you get a degree in marketing? Right. Like, what is going on here? We've talked about it. You know how bullish I am on this. I think that the media business around print magazines is terrible. But the business of print magazines for content marketing is beautiful.
That's right.
It's no greater can you find a loyalty effort. I think if you're looking to create better customers, sending them a print magazine on a regular basis where you know they're going to get it, they will not get blocked. It's not like, you know, where I'm sending through Gmail and Gmail might say, I'm going to put that to spam. I'm going to put that in the promotions tab. The U.S. Postal Service doesn't do that. They don't look at that nylon and say, that's spam. That's not good. They deliver everything, even though it's crap. They're going to deliver it.
I love your voice of the post office.
I'm going to deliver your nylon magazine today. Yeah. I think this stuff works. And the challenge is, and the guy that's running, what's the guy running?
Topolsky?
Joshua Topolsky.
Yeah.
What I love about what he's saying when he's talking about Robin Hood's media arm, he's saying this is a significant long-term investment.
Yeah.
They are getting into this. And that's if he said, we're looking for immediate impact and immediate revenue gains direct. I mean, of course, you mentioned this, but the book Killing Marketing is all about this, about how it's basically, if you were going to take our book and say, give me an example of it, it's Sherwood Media.
Yeah.
It's exactly what they're trying to do. They're saying, we're launching this for marketing purposes. We're launching it because we're going to have better relationships with our customers. But at the same time, we can drive direct revenue just fine, just like a media company does, and maybe better because we have more resources to do it.
Right. And it doesn't have to be profitable, right? I mean, that's what, you know, I mean, one of the things that you talk, we interviewed, and I'm forgetting his name, great, very smart guy, who was at Red Bull Media House. And when we interviewed him for the book, and we talked about the revenue generation of Red Bull Media House. And he was the first one to say, look, we're not profitable. Like but we don't have to be, right? We're not built to be a profitable business. We're built to just mitigate the costs of marketing and how we create content to create that better relationship with our potential buyers and, you know, and existing consumers. So that's one of the things when we talked about this, when we talked about all of the magazines that Arrow Electronics purchased. Mm-hmm. All of those magazines, any individual one of those magazines, newsletters and all, the 53 publications that they purchased as part of their ongoing acquisition of all these properties in the engineering space, to an individual, some of them maybe just above profitability, some of them just below profitability, some of them, not profitable very much at all. And they can right size that as they need to. But the point is that they can subsidize. It's basically a subsidized marketing play, right? Where it becomes a lot cheaper to do something really interesting because you're actually making enough money to subsidize it to some degree, 70%, 80%, 90%, 60%.
Cleveland Clinic is another great example.
Exactly.
As well.
Exactly.
With their Health Essentials blog, and they monetize that in multiple ways. So yeah, absolutely. I think that if you're launching a content initiative today, your first and foremost effort is, hey, I need to build audience because I want to show that we're making a behavior, we're helping to lead a behavior change in our customers.
Yes.
But while you're doing that, you should also be thinking, oh, well, we can generate revenue in other ways so we can support this thing. Because at the end of the day, I don't want to go hat in hand to the CMO and say, please give me budget for all my content stuff. You want to say, I need a little budget. I need a little help here. I don't need all the help. And, so that's why I think that anyone that's launching an event, a webinar series, book series, whatever the case is, that can all be funded through outside initiatives if you think about it strategically from the
outside. That's right. That's right. Yeah. We somewhere along the line in the last 20 years, we conflated the viability of advertising in print as a business model to the value that consumers put in print as a as an artifact of the way that they want to consume content. And those two things are not connected, right? That, you know, it's it's they value those things. I mean, I remember talking with John Deere about their print magazine, you know, The Furrow, which they've been publishing for 125 years at this point. And they he would show me pictures of their subscribers who sent in, you know, they would have a basket in their kitchen with, you know, 30 issues stacked up in there that they just kept because they're, you know, they one considered them collector's items, but two, they could go back and reread and enjoy and sort of collect and have, you know, they become pieces of artifacts and pieces of art almost in the way that you can create that. So it's incredible.
The only thing that I will say about this is, I guess why I'm pushing print so hard is because so many senior marketers forgot it was an option.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. It's still events are still an option. Books are still an option. Print magazines are still an option. And because everyone seems to be focused, the world news is focused on social media platforms, doesn't mean that these things aren't viable to look at. So if you're a responsible marketer, I think you need to look at all the ways that you can reach your customers effectively.
Yep.
Print's just one of them. But it got so down. It's been so down in the dirt lately because it's like, oh, okay, everything, all our money's going digitally. Really? Okay. That's responsible. That's good job. Good for you.
Good for you.
Don't forget the post office. Delivering your mail. I love the post office, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. I love the post office.
I do.
Okay, very quickly here, we're going to cover another quick story about AI and content. And this is coming to us courtesy of the New York Times, which is going a little viral across social media. It's been sent to me like four or five times from various people. The headline that is going around is how tech giants cut corners to harvest data for AI. The article opens up by saying, in late 2021, OpenAI faced a supply problem. The artificial intelligence lab had exhausted every reservoir of reputable English language text on the internet. As it develops its latest AI system, it needed more data to train the next version of its technology. Oh my God, it sounds like the opening to a Spielberg movie. So OpenAI researchers created a speech recognition tool called Whisper. It could transcribe the audio from YouTube videos, yielding new conversational text that would make an AI system smarter. Some OpenAI employees discussed how such a move might go against YouTube's rules. You've tried to figure out how you could. You never figured out how you should. Anyway, so the article goes on to talk at some great length about how Google, OpenAI, and others are cutting the corners by slurping up all of this data and content out there. And it mentions the fact that the New York Times are actually suing these companies for content that it has ingested from the New York Times. It's claiming proprietary copyright infringement and all those kinds of things. So very quickly, and I think we can cover this quickly because we've talked about it at some length before. Any comments on this? Any takes on this? Are we finally seeing a backlash against this, or is this something that's just ultimately going to be, nah, this is what we do?
I think you're going to continue to see a backlash around it, but I don't think it's going to do any good.
Yeah.
I think that what happened and couldn't have happened any other way. So now that we just, as we're
a great way to put it, that's a great way to put it. Yeah.
That's kind of where we're at right now. And I guess where I'm more concerned is that they seem to be creating more artificially generated content to continue to train. So we're off. I honestly don't know how to feel about this, Robert. It's weird. It's like, okay, well, we're out of data. So what do? We got to create more content. How do we create more content? AI is going to create more content so we can learn off of that content. And I'm like, what is going to be the truth? It's already so messy out there with everybody having their own platforms that they look at. And you might see something that I don't see because I'm just looking at this direction. Well, now we've got the future of search and how we learn based on their training themselves.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Which is, you know, from what I understand, and my understanding is limited here for sure, this synthetic content that you refer to, which is basically AI creating content that then teaches additional AI how, you know, about the content itself. That seems to me to be there's got to be some challenge with that. I've done a little reading on this, but from what I understand is that you can work yourself into a quality loop here that really just starts to degrade very quickly after a certain amount of iterations, where you start getting into sort of the self-fulfilling prophecy of, because it's more probable the AI creates it, therefore when it creates it, it becomes more probable, and you start getting into repetition cycles and all those kinds of things. I just wonder when we look back on this, and even today when we look at what's going on, because by the way, to your point, that horse has left the barn, like it's done, right? They got it all, right? It's already in the systems. You know, now they're just looking at new sources of content that, you know, and should they continue to be allowed to be to provide new content across the internet in there. I wonder if we really understand as a public what we're really upset about. Like what are we upset about? Are we upset that it took content to its, you know, we want AI to be really good. We want it to be really, you know, valuable as an innovation on our planet. So what is it we're really upset about as a public? Are we upset about our content? Like it's one of those things sort of like the way I look at it is kind of, you know, it's like when people complain about traffic, right? You know, oh, I hate being, it's, you know, they're in the middle of a freeway and they're in traffic. It's like, well, no, you are traffic. You mm-hmm. are the problem, you know? And in many ways, what we're upset about, for example, the New York Times is clearly upset about, is not that the rest of the internet got slurped up for AI. It's that their content, their special, wonderful, you know, golden child content got slurped up for AI because their content is special. But is it? Is it really? Because I want New York Times content to be in there for the value of AI. So it's basically, are we upset that it's all getting put into AI, or are we only upset that it's our content getting put into AI for the learning model? We weren't that upset, clearly. We weren't that upset when it got slurped up for Google indexing to provide for Google search. So, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be upset. I just wonder if we've really asked ourselves as a culture, what is it we're really upset about? Because to date, from what I've seen, the learning models aren't, you know, and I know that there are exceptions to this, and I know that there are creative people out there that have very passionate views on this. But it seems like it is actually getting used to create new work, not necessarily derivative or copied work. So I just don't know. You know, I don't think we understand as a culture what it is we're really upset about when it comes to the slurping up of all this data. So I think it's going to be really interesting to watch the lawsuits, especially.
Yeah, and I'm not smart enough to know.
I'm not either.
I just try to continue to build the bunker.
Yeah.
There
it is.
I will go there when the time is right. Or look at that plot in Wyoming that looks really good.
I don't
know why Wyoming.
I went to a nonprofit event last night for this new organization that I've done a little bit of research on. It's called Rewilding America, and they're basically rewilding all these horses, these, you know, feral horses that have sort of roamed the Idaho and Wyoming and Montana and are out on these ranchers' lands, and the BLM sort of takes these horses, and, you know, there's a whole thing there I won't waste the time to go down into, but it's fascinating. This nonprofit is basically taking these horses and rehabilitating them and then reintroducing them back into the wild to maintain a population of wild horses.
Wow.
It's really fascinating sort of stuff that is way under the radar of most people, except if you live in Montana or Wyoming. So as you get your bunker done, make sure you save some land for the wild horse.
Sounds like a Garth Brooks song.
Yeah. Oh, it should be. Horses. It should be. Trust me. Yeah, it should be. Should be. All right.
It's like all those chickens in Key West just running around pecking at my feet.
There's a joke right there. And I'm not going near the joke.
You go inside a bar and there's like just
It's like Hawaii. Yeah, there's all sorts of chickens everywhere. All right, let's get to our speaking of chickens pecking at our feet. Oh dear. Hits and misses, where we each pick a winner and a loser, or loser, I should say, from this week in marketing. Do you want to go first or shall I go first with my hit? And you have a hit as well. I think we both have hits this week.
I'll be really brief. We'll put this in. All the links are in the show notes. I watched Jack Conte's, the CEO founder of Patreon's YouTube presentation that he gave at South by Southwest just a few weeks ago. And it is mandatory watching, I believe, for every marketer and content creator.
I started it. Yeah.
Basically, in a nutshell, in a nutshell, he goes through, web one, web two, which we know about, and then goes through this generation that we're in right now of the 2010s plus into ranking and what ranking has done for the follower, for the subscriber. It has been detrimental to a media company, a marketer, and a creator. And we're sort of trying to deal with it. Mm. And he comes up with this idea that, are we at the death of the follower? Now, he doesn't believe that we're at the death of the follower being what maintains all of our business, our marketing business, content marketing business, our creator business. It's all from direct connections with fans. Yeah. And this disintermediation that's happening with but tech companies making these decisions for the benefit of their business, which is doing really well. Jack talks about that process, what he's doing about it, what he thinks about it, what creators and marketers need to do about it. So it's 46 minutes long. I watched the whole thing. I'm going to watch it again. I'll probably watch it again. I think it's that impactful. So I'll put it in the show notes. Go watch it. It's worth your time.
That's good stuff. That's good stuff. I have a big hit, which is making the rounds. It didn't get introduced this week, but it's been around for a few weeks now. But I finally got turned on to it and went and got a paid account. It was Suno.ai, which I think you can still get there at Suno.ai, but you can also get there at Suno.com now. So it looks like they got their .com game going. It is basically you're prompted for you. So if you have the paid version, you can not just prompt and say, I'd like a fast-paced country western blues song, but you can actually put in lyrics. Like, you can actually type in the lyrics that you want the song to have, and you hit go, and out comes, in about 30 seconds, a two-minute version of the song.
No way.
That you've just created through AI, and it's really good. I mean,
it must be good because you're the musician.
Well, look, okay.
You are usually down on these types of things.
Here's the thing. Wow. Here's the impressive part. Now, as a musician, I can immediately hear the problems, right? The six fingers and the, sort of melting faces of Dolly and, all those kinds of things. I can hear the challenges with it, right? First of all, the vocals are really limited in terms of the kinds of vocals that you hear. The instrumentation across the different genres is pretty similar. But if you're doing things like, I had to do a blues, for example. I took a song that I had written in the 1990s, it was a blues song that I had written that used to play live in the bands that I was in. And I gave it the lyrics, and I said, give me sort of a country rock blues feel to this. I had to spit out, it's pretty cheap. In other words, you can have a spit out multiple versions, not a lot of, the number of credits you get are pretty generous. So I had to spit out maybe, I don't know, eight versions of it. And the seventh version was impressive. Now, I could hear that the blues progression wasn't quite right. That wasn't really a 12 bar blues. It was, there's some mistakes, mm-hmm. but as a sketch pad, as a sort of just very quick background music. So just, spoiler alert, the background music that you heard underneath the Divi ad was created by Suno. And so go back and listen to that ad, or go back and watch that ad if you're on the YouTube channel. And that music is coming out of Suno, and there's some very funny stuff coming out on TikTok now of people putting in, making these sort of electronic dance songs with funny lyrics, like, I got to go poop and, so sorts of funny things.
Yeah.
It's really impressive. So it's my big hit for this week.
Good. Jeez. I feel like checking it out.
I think it's fun. It's a fun toy.
That's great. Thank you.
It is a toy, but it is a, I think if you're in the business of creating like very, you know, like sort of Muzak as it were, sort of elevator music, it's that's the kind of thing that this is likely to replace because, you know, it's pretty darn good, but it is, you know, it's self-similar by, you know, go play with it. It's really fascinating.
That's crazy. Yeah. All right.
Now it is time very quickly for our rants and raves where Joe and I go off on a little bit of a rant or a little bit of a rave that makes us feel like, what's up, brother? Tuesday. I just think that's so funny.
I'm gonna have to find it now.
So I went on TikTok and I started seeing this meme, and I'm not a Twitch viewer. But because of the TikTok meme, I actually went out and found this guy, Sketch, and watched his stuff. And he's really funny. He's really, really funny. I mean, you gotta be into watching him play football, but you know, He's very amusing. He's very, very amusing. And the meme is very funny too. Okay. Anyway, so we're getting into rants and raves. Do you want to go first here?
Yeah,
I mean, we both have raves again.
There's so many good things that are going on right now. So I found this, and I found it on the New York Post here, and I'll put the link in the show notes, but there's a TikToker. Her name is Kelsey Russell. And I would call this a tilt so much. She gets on and she reads from a print newspaper. She's 23. She's reading from a print newspaper, and she's trying to teach Gen Z about how to be media literate by reading a print newspaper. So every time she gets a local paper, she gets a New York Times or Washington Post or something like that, and she's reading an article, and she's dissecting it, and she's talking about the importance of print media and how you can be literate. It's funny. She got into that tilt, if you will, or that niche, because somebody asked her, I think, a question about something about the New York Times, and she didn't know how to answer it or how to be equipped to have a discussion about that. And she's like, I'm going to learn it. She learns it. She's teaching it. And I love this because everyone talks about, I want to find my content niche, or there's no way I can go niche enough. Or here, just look at, She's a TikTok. She's got 90,000 followers. She's making a business out of this. She's getting really great exposure about this little thin thing about being the expert for Gen Z about reading a print magazine or print newspapers. Come on. I love it. So congrats. Rave out to Kelsey. Put it in the show notes. Check it out. It's really interesting. It's not like something that I would want to watch, but I'm not the target.
Exactly. Thankfully. So that's good stuff. Learning to read a newspaper.
I know, crazy. We should probably start a whole channel on just things that are outdated that we want to teach kids about.
Like how to read the classified section, in a newspaper, or what the classified section used to actually look like. Remember when you used to scan, when you were trying to find a job and you would open up the newspaper into the jobs, you know, basically the job section, and you would go through and you would circle the jobs that you could apply for. You would get your resume and you would fold it up and you would actually put it into an envelope and send it off to the company, basically applying for that job. Or you would call, you might call and leave a voicemail and hopefully get something back. It's fascinating.
I have no idea what you're talking about. You're old.
I'm old.
All right. What do you got?
I don't know. This is commentary more than anything else. First of all, I want to thank Heath Dingwell, friend and family of the show for sure, who we had a discussion online about this. Are you familiar with Andrew Huberman?
No, I am not. I saw the link that you sent. I was not.
Yeah, he's a Stanford, I guess, professor in health. And he's now become sort of a Joe Rogan-esque like character from his podcast and his videos that he creates on health, basically proactive health, right? Everything from intermittent fasting to, you know, how to eat better, how to take care of yourself, how to take care of disease, you know, all these kinds of things, right? So it immediately sets him up for sort of the, you know, much of it is, I guess, might be what you call like new age type of healthcare, especially sort of the stuff like on intermittent fasting and diet and mm-hmm. those kinds of things. But in any event, he has guests and he does this, and he's become very big. He's become a very big sort of influencer in that space. I've watched a few of his shows, which are long. Typically, they're really long podcasts. But I've, for example, I was toying with intermittent fasting, and I watched him talk with a guy, an expert in intermittent fasting, and it was a fascinating discussion. And I ended up doing some stuff with it. Anyway, he got in trouble, and the discussion that Heath and I were having online about this was sort of the fact that he got in trouble. Slate basically wrote an article basically saying, you know, he's a quack, you know, da 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 da, you know, can you trust him, and all those sorts of things. And then a New York Post article came out sort of even worse, sort of talking about him. And he's starting to get a lot of backlash now on his celebrity. And the discussion that Heath and I were having was, one, is this inevitable for basically any influencer that reaches a certain size, right? It's sort of, you know, Galloway talks about this a lot, right? Once you get to a certain size or a certain size of audience, details matter, accuracy matters, all those kinds of things that didn't matter before, because you get called out. And in many ways, you get called out because you're influential. In other words, the way that somebody else becomes influential is by calling you out as being influential, right? And so we were having this this discussion about, is this inevitable for people, and is he handling it the right way? Because what came out coming out of all of this was that he had hired a PR firm that was trying to sort of quell the fire and put the fire out with his PR and, you know, his now marketing. And what I came back to Heath with, and I said this, I said, look, the fact that he's now hiring a PR firm to do crisis communications is indicative that he didn't have one when he started to come up. And it's one of the mistakes that I see that, you know, at a much smaller scale that I see content creators making now, which is not thinking enough, you know, sort of overestimating their ability to handle the idea of themselves as an influencer or as a celebrity without getting sort of professional and sort of or managerial help, right? Which is, so it's, I guess it's more than anything, this is a safety tip, right? When you start to look at it, you get a little bit famous, right? You get a little bit famous, you get, you know, you still have a lot of leeway to F up, right? But as soon as you reach a certain level, that leeway goes away, and your everything you say becomes under critical, sort of ideas, right? Look at Joe Rogan, look at him, look at all these people that sort of inevitably get to some level of size of audience. And at some point, it's not an if, it's a when it's going to happen, when you're going to say that thing that ultimately gets you in trouble with some audience, rightfully or wrongfully. And so the key here is knowing when to hire a professional to help you manage your brand, manage as a content creator, as a media brand, knowing when you can have someone A, create all the guardrails that you need. In other words, save you from yourself, save you from saying that stupid thing or that lie or whatever. And then B, helping you manage your brand. So if you are going to be that Joe Rogan, if you are going to say the stupid thing purposely in order to create controversy, that you at least understand what the ramifications and implications are for your personal brand there and yourself as a media brand, so that you can do this. And it's just, I guess his story here is really just sort of a cautionary tale about handling this as a marketer, as a content marketer, and as a creator of, when do you want to actually create controversy versus increasing your reach and awareness and brand? And how does that affect how people see you in the world?
Well, luckily, we'll never be that big.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. That's what I was, but you were saying that. I'm like, do we need crisis communications help? I'm like, no,
it is true.
I don't think we do. I don't think it's going to happen.
It is true.
It's gonna. We're going funny. Even targeted, more targeted to a smaller audience.
Oh my god, that's very
and
funny.
And they forgive us because we know we're idiots. They know we're idiots, but they that's love right. us anyways.
That's right. We're just a couple of chuckleheads.
That's exactly how that works. No, okay. Very good example.
Yeah.
All right. What do you got going on, sir?
I am actually traveling a little bit. I'm headed to the East Coast, New York, and Danbury, Connecticut. Yeehaw. I'll be in Danbury, Connecticut at the early part of next week, visiting with a new client, and getting all set up there. And then, of course, back next week to record the show and all of that. And honestly, working through my presentation for CEX, it's, I'm really looking forward to it, and I'm trying to make this a really good one. Like, I really want to make this valuable for this audience, 'cause I know it's a very smart, savvy audience. So I'm trying to really press against the edges of the box here. So I'm working through that.
I said, I'm doing the same thing. I've been writing, especially after seeing Jack Conte's presentation, I'm trying to,
yeah, you want to
figure
take
out,
it up a notch. Yeah, take it up.
Exactly. Well, I've got to, I'm opening it up, on May 6th. So I'm like, I really want to, I want to set the stage, and I don't want to be overly negative, because as you and I have talked about, it's not an easy time for creators and content marketers. No. You and I know a lot of people that are struggling right now.
Yeah.
And so we want to set the stage for success there. And it's not easy. I'm leaving tomorrow for golf.
Of course you are.
So yeah.
Of course you are. The man of leisure.
I told you, I'm like, I was off for 7 days on vacation. I worked really hard for 2.5 days because I had to take Eclipse Day off.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, so
it's self-care. You need a self-care day, really, because you don't really get them enough.
No, I gotta say something about the eclipse. I didn't know if it would be that big of a deal going into it, so I played along. We had the party, whatever. It did not disappoint. One of the greatest things
one of the greatest eclipses ever.
I've never seen a totality eclipse. With my youngest, we were talking about it. We're like, we're sitting having dinner together, and he's like, you know, Dad, that eclipse, it did not disappoint. He's like, I'm like, right?
That's awesome.
I like, it's just hard to explain how I've talked to some people that have been laughing at me. They're like you, like, oh my God, it was like, it's just an eclipse. It's like, no. It was a very spiritual moment.
But how did they convert? How did the eclipse convert? I mean, you know, they got a lot of reach, but did they get a lot of, I mean, it's a good viral video.
Jesus, I'm done. You go end the show.
Thank you very much. We will see you again next week, folks. And in the meantime, before we see you again next week with one of our regular episodes, remember, it's your story to tell. Tell it well. We'll see you next week on This Old Marketing.
Hey, thanks a lot for making it this far in this week's episode, and thank you all for being a part of This Old Marketing. You can check out all the show notes of what we talked about today at thisoldmarketing.com, and it's also where you can leave us a review or a voicemail. We need those reviews and comments on whichever platform you follow us on. And if you haven't followed the podcast, please go do that and make sure you catch the latest and greatest episodes every Friday morning. We're on Apple and Spotify and all your other favorite podcatchers, of course, but we'd love it if you went over and subscribed to us on YouTube. That's right, YouTube. YouTube.com/@thisoldmarketing. We'll see you again next week, folks, with another episode of This Old Marketing.